This podcast is, of course, made possible through the support of our members and from Dartmouth Hitchcock. Imagine nationally ranked healthcare in your community with convenient locations throughout northern New England. World-class providers are closer than you think. Visit dartmouthhitchcock.org to learn more. Dartmouth Hitchcock is here.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. This hour, it's the second in our two-part series on cancer in the Granite State. Last week, we mapped New Hampshire's profile when it comes to this disease. For example, it turns out that Granite Staters are more likely to get lung cancer than Americans elsewhere, not so much because we smoke more, but because of naturally occurring radon. We also learned that in terms of surviving cancer, New Hampshire does better than most states. This hour, our conversation turns to treatment. And while there's a lot to cover here, we'll focus on two areas. One, excitement over an approach called immunotherapy. And later, rising attention to the cost and complexity of cancer care, a term called logistic toxicity, the administrative and fiscal burden that, turns out, has a measurable effect on patient health. Today in The Exchange, part two of our cancer series, looking at new aspects of treatment. Let's hear from you. The Exchange number, 1-800-892-6477. 1-800-892-NHPR. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. We have three guests with me in studio. Is Emma Dan. She's nurse director at the Dana-Farber Cancer Institute Satellite Office in Londonderry. And Emma, it's really nice to meet you. Thank you for being here.
Thank you for having me.
Joining us from Hanover is Dr. Stephen Feiring. He's a professor of microbiology, immunology, and genetics at Dartmouth College's Geisel School of Medicine. And Dr. Feiring, good to have you too. Thanks for your time.
Good morning. It's nice to be here.
And also with us from Boston, Dr. Elizabeth Bookbinder, immunotherapy expert and melanoma specialist at the Dana-Farber Cancer Institute in Boston. And Dr. Bookbinder, good to have you too. Thanks for your time.
Hi, it's a pleasure to be here.
Well, before we get into this new field that's having some promising results, I did want to ask all three of you, as people who work in this field of cancer, about the proposal that President Obama unveiled in his State of the Union address about half a year ago. It's what he called a new moonshot to cure cancer, putting the vice president in charge, and there's been some activity around this. Let's hear President Obama.
So tonight I'm announcing a new national effort to get it done. And because he's gone to the mat for all of us on so many issues over the past 40 years, I'm putting Joe in charge of mission control. For the loved ones we've all lost, for the families that we can still save, let's make America the country that cures cancer once and for all. What do you say, Joe? Let's make it happen.
President Obama in his State of the Union address about 6 months ago. And I'll turn to you first, I think, Dr. Feiring, you know, as someone who works deeply in this field, what was your reaction to that moonshot, you know, let's make America the country that cures cancer?
Well, I think that there's a variety of thoughts that are worth sharing. The first is that what the federal government has and can do is invest money in research, most of it coming through the National Institute of Health. And that's really the fuel that drives the research that is has been consistently improving treatment for patients over a number of years. I think it's nice public relations to talk about curing cancer, but I think the reality is that at some level, cancer is always going to be part of the human experience. But I think what we can do and what has been going on and what can be accelerated with more funding is we can improve the outcomes for more people so that more people are able to survive having been diagnosed with cancer for longer periods of time, living higher qualities of life. And I think a good example to look at might be heart disease, which people are now, because of a lot of interventions, able to live quite long and productive lives with what would have maybe 30 or 40 or 50 years ago been something that would have cut their life quite short. And so to me, that's the real goal, is improving outcomes disease by disease, because as we all know, cancer is not just one disease.
It's hundreds of diseases, from what I understand, some easier to cure than others. What do you think, Dr. Bookbinder? Let's make America the country that cures cancer. It sounds nice, but it's complicated.
Yeah, it's definitely complicated, but I think there's some excitement around what's going on, particularly in the area of being able to pull together large pieces of data. So with cancer, we're often looking at genetics and looking at tons and tons of information and being able to pull data together from all over the country and kind of pick out what's going on in a way that we can't necessarily do as individual institutions looking at just our patient population. So I think there's a lot of excitement about what this may mean in terms of being able to merge together the collective minds of the country and merge some of that data together, too. I think there's a lot of excitement around it.
Well, and Dr. Bookbinder, the moonshot announcement was about 6 months ago now. Have you seen it make a difference? I mean, here we are in July.
Yeah, so I know there's some efforts moving forward in terms of putting into place mechanisms for some of the efforts around the moonshot in terms of some of the genetic, catch-alls and collections and starting to build those infrastructure. I think it's going to be a while before we see a lot of results from the effort, but I think the infrastructure and some of the planning is getting into place.
Yeah, and Em, I do have to turn to you. You know, here you are working with patients, people who are really struggling and their families. How did that sound to you?
As an oncology nurse, I thought it was really exciting, but the best honor was that they also chose to include oncology nurses, and the Oncology Nursing Society has representatives at the table with Joe Biden to plan this project. So it was just neat that it wasn't specifically related to the science and that the patient experience was also included.
Well, we'll definitely get the patient experience from you this hour, which is why it's good you're here, Emma. I did want to ask all of you also about some of the new areas that you are working on, Dr. Bookbinder, and you, Dr. Firing. But before we get to that, can we just get a real basic explanation, Dr. Firing, please, of how cancer is treated today? The typical, you know, 2, 3, 4 tools in the toolkit.
Well, the first tools, the oldest tool, is surgery, and if the surgery can be done and a identified tumor is removed and there is no metastasis, then there's likelihood that the patient will not have a relapse. And after surgery, which has been around for quite a long time, radiotherapy using radiation to kill tumors was developed in the early part of the 1900s. And through the middle part of the 1900s. And those two are very standard. And then the third piece that was developed after that was chemotherapy, in which drugs were brought in that were able to kill cancer cells. And so those have been the mainstream of therapy. And as we have briefly touched on, different types of cancers have different outcomes. Some are quite good, and some are still quite poor. There's two really exciting things, and one is that the chemotherapy is now becoming much more targeted, whereas the previous generations of chemotherapy were generally just drugs which would be preferentially lethal to cells that were dividing. The new generation of targeted chemotherapies is working on specific pathways, and as Dr. Bookbinder mentioned, we're getting more genetic information about individual patients and their cancers, and we can identify genetic pathways, many of which now have these targeted chemotherapies.
So just to put in real basic terms, Dr. Firing, the standard chemo was just kind of wash the body with chemotherapy. Now you can target that chemotherapy more to the part of the body that is filled with the cancer, is that right?
Well, no, targeted is a word we use in the trade so much, but what it really means is it's hitting particular molecules.
Oh, I see. Okay.
That are not operating properly in the tumor. And so it could potentially have fewer side effects as compared to the earlier generations of chemotherapy, many of which are still used all the time and are quite effective, that are just They mainly attack dividing cells.
Well,
there are other cells in the body that are dividing besides the cancer.
And Emma, you know, we hear so much about the terrible side effects of chemotherapy. And I've had friends who've had cancer, you know, over the past year or so. And the side effects of chemo are terrible still. Just remind us of what your patients go through when they're undergoing chemotherapy.
So luckily, our patients have an oncology nurse by their side as part of the team. And so we work closely with the medical providers to administer drugs that help to manage the symptoms that these patients are going through. And so the days of yesteryear of really patients having a lot of nausea and vomiting are really not as extensive anymore because we have the right medication to give these patients. Right now, we worry about patients having a risk of infection. Patients still lose their hair with certain therapies. And really, they have a lot of fatigue. And that's what the oncology nurse helps these patients to manage.
So because the nausea, everybody's heard of that. So you're saying it's not as bad as it used to be, or?
Not as bad as it used to be. It still happens.
It's still bad,
but we have
a lot
of great agents that can help.
Well, and other side effects, you know, nausea, pain, fatigue, from what I understand, is just deep and really
and surprising.
And surprising. Anemia, bone density loss, blood clots, infertility, lung dysfunction, heart damage. This is some of the stuff that is in the research. Pretty terrible stuff. Can last not just during treatment, but long after. And it makes me wonder, Dr. Bookbinder, you know, why can't we do better than this? I mean, it still seems really, really, really hard for people.
Right. Well, so a lot of the therapies, the chemotherapies, as mentioned previously, we're kind of targeting not just the cancer cells, but hitting a lot of normal cells. And I think that's the big issue, is therapies that only target cancer specifically. If we had that perfect silver bullet, then we wouldn't have all these other side effects and other toxicities. And that's kind of what we're working harder and harder to reach with some of these targeted therapies, and then hopefully with more and more development in the immune therapy realm.
So if you can target it more, then the effects might be diminished, Dr. Bookbinder, is that it?
Yeah, so if you can find treatments that really just act on the cancer and don't act on normal cells, then you limit a lot of those other side effects in terms of hair loss, nausea, and other things that happen within the body.
Although one of the nasty things about cancer, and you all know this better than I do, Dr. Feiring, is that it can spread. So you think you have, you know, cancer of the colon, and then voila, it spreads to your liver or, you know, other parts of the body. So is that an argument, Dr. Feiring, for doing this sort of broad brush chemo treatment?
Well, that has been the available treatment for metastatic disease, which is what you're describing. And I think that's why there is so much excitement about immunotherapy, because the three big therapies that we discussed of surgery, radiation, and chemotherapy, the only one that can really be used to try to treat cancer after it's already spread is chemotherapy. Now we're developing immunotherapy, in which the patient's own immune system is stimulated and supported in attacking the tumor, because the patient's immune system recognizes that this is not the right thing. This is not, as we talk about in immunology, self. This is something that's sort of recognized like we would recognize a pathogen, a bacteria or something. And so that can work on metastatic disease, because it's not localized. It's throughout the whole body. And so that's one reason why there's tremendous excitement.
Our phone number for you to join us here in the exchange is 1-800-892-6477. 1-800-892-NHPR. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. Again, the number 1-800-892-6477. Today in the exchange, it's the second in our two-part look on cancer in the Granite State. We're finding out about some advances in cancer treatment, specifically something called immunotherapy. Later on, we'll look at what's called the financial toxicity of cancer. You can join us now at 1-800-892-6477. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Again, find us on Facebook or Twitter. One more question for you, Emma, about the traditional approach toward cancer treatment now, and then we'll get into definitely immunotherapy and some of the exciting news around there. In terms of the people who come to you, Emma, you know, what are their sort of fears and concerns about these different tools in the toolkit?
I think their biggest fear is this is all new to them, so they really don't understand what to expect, and they're really seeking a lot of information, or they've gone to the internet or to their friends and heard probably not the great stories.
Really?
And so they are just afraid that it's going to be a terrible, terrible experience and they're going to be alone. And so I think reassuring them that there's a whole team caring for them and that will address whatever their need is when they have it. Once we find that as nurses at the chairside, we spend time teaching them at the very beginning, the physician has spent time with them, they meet the social worker if they need to, the nutritionist, the rehab team, whoever it is, and then they have more information and they're empowered to feel more settled as they go through this experience.
How long have you been in this field, Emma?
Almost 20 years.
Almost 20 years. What have you seen over that time? What's the biggest change in terms of patient success, for example? I mean, are we seeing people be cured more or living longer? What have you seen over that long time?
So I think my colleagues that have been in the field longer have seen more of a drastic change because I kind of started at the time where the drastic change really started.
But, really?
Yeah. I mean, our patients are definitely having a better experience. We've learned more as a profession on how to take care of these patients, as a society, how to take care of these patients. And so I just see that patients... It's really neat to see the transformation from patients that really start afraid, and then by the time they're done, they almost don't want to leave our clinic, which is, I'm sure they
okay,
really do want
crazy.
To leave our clinic, but they have developed the relationships and they felt that trust. And I guess that's the biggest transformation that I've seen is that we have been able to take better care of patients, and patients certainly are surviving cancers a lot more than they ever were even my 20 years ago.
Really? Now that's interesting.
Mm-hmm.
Because of improved therapies?
Improved treatments, early diagnosis, prevention, screening tools. I mean, we're catching cancers earlier, which means we have a better chance of treating them.
Very interesting. Well, let's turn to what our two doctors are working on, and that's immunotherapy. And I think, Dr. Fine, I'll start with you, but I want to hear from you too, Dr. Bookbinder. But Dr. Fine, you started explaining how this works, and let's go there, sort of the basic idea behind immunotherapy. My understanding is the fundamentals of this idea go back to the 1890s.
That's quite correct, actually. The first person to write about it scientifically was a New York physician named William Coley. And the basic idea is, and it's since Coley's time, there's been a lot of discussion about whether the immune system recognizes cancer. So the immune system is, as I'm sure most of the listeners know, very important in keeping us all healthy because it protects us from pathogens, bacteria, viruses, fungi, that can make us sick. And that's something that people have understood or at least recognized for quite a while, but there's been pretty much of a 100-year debate about whether cancer is recognized by the immune system. And that's because it really is self. I mean, it's your own cells, but there are genetic differences. And that debate has been resolved, and it's clear that cancer is recognized by the immune system, and there is... I don't want to say always, but certainly in most situations, there is an immune response that at least begins to try to eliminate the cancer. And it's quite likely that there are many cancers that get eliminated in many of us. We didn't even know they existed. They were small. The immune system recognizes them. It takes them out, and nobody ever knew what happened.
Wow. So you're saying some of us have had small, not very powerful cancers, maybe, and our immune system took care of it for us.
Yeah, I think that's almost certainly true, except it's the sort of information that's very hard to get because nobody knew it was there.
That's exciting and creepy at the same time, Dr. Fire.
yeah, but I think it's just like many of us would have gotten a cold. But our immune system took care of it before it ever developed into a cold in which there was a full-blown immune response, right? So I think that that's sort of analogous to pathogens, or we could have gotten a bacterial infection, but our immune system took care of it, and that we never knew about it. So I think it's sort of similar.
Well, and Dr. Bookbinder, I'll get your thoughts on this, too. And we'll start taking your calls in just a moment. 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. More on cancer treatment in a moment. The This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, it's the second in our two-part series on cancer. Today, we're looking at what's new in cancer treatment and research. A little bit later in the hour, we'll look at the financial and emotional toll of cancer. 1-800-892-6477 is the number for you to join us. 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. Our guests are Dr. Stephen Fiering. He's a professor of microbiology, immunology, and genetics at Dartmouth College's Geisel School of Medicine. With me in studio, Emma Dan, nurse director at the Dana-Farber Cancer Institute Satellite Office in Londonderry. And Dr. Elizabeth Bookbinder is also with us, immunotherapy expert and melanoma specialist at the Dana-Farber Cancer Institute in Boston. And Dr. Bookbinder, let's talk a little bit more about immunotherapy, which is what, again, you and Dr. Fiering are working on. You're a specialist, as I said, in the field of melanoma, and there was a lot of interest just recently about former President Jimmy Carter having melanoma and getting cured, maybe, by immunotherapy. Can we say Jimmy Carter was cured by this?
Yeah, we're very hesitant to yet say cured because we don't know what a lot of the long-term data is going to look like with some of these new immunotherapies. But at this point, he has no evidence of disease, which is really exciting. And actually, as Dr. Fiering was talking about, the idea that the immune system could actually eliminate little tumors, that may have been what was kind of the case in his initial presentation, because they never found where his melanoma came from on his skin. And that's something that we see not uncommonly, where it seems as if the immune system has gotten rid of the original tumor, but that later tumors elsewhere grow from that original melanoma. And in his case, I think it was brain and liver is what I'd heard. And he was placed on an immune therapy that got rid of any evidence of his melanoma.
Wow. So what do we conclude from this, that it works for melanoma but nothing else? Or?
Well, so initially it was tested in melanoma, but then also in some other diseases that are very intricately related to the immune system, such as kidney cancer. But over time, what we've seen is that actually there is some effect in many, many malignancies. So we're seeing effects in lung cancer, bladder cancer, some of the leukemia, lymphomas, some of the other GYN cancers, uterine cancer, ovarian cancer, even some types of breast cancer and some types of colon cancer. So it's really very, very exciting because it seems as if not just melanoma, but a lot of other malignancies beyond this may be responding to some of these immunotherapies.
Well, and those cancers that you mentioned, Dr. Bookbinder, lung, bladder, uterine, I mean, those have high levels. We have higher levels in New Hampshire than the rest of the country of those cancers. So that would be good news for the Granite State. Are you getting questions, Emma, from your patients about, you know, can I get this immunotherapy?
Well, some patients come to us seeking immunotherapy, but some patients really don't know and so take the advice of their physician. But patients have sought us out and they said they saw it on TV or read it in the news and they would like that option for themselves. And they don't necessarily understand that their cancer may or may not be a candidate for that treatment, but we help them through that.
Yeah, that's hard too. There's a lot of information out there on the internet, on television, wherever. Promising breakthrough, exciting new development, and then you have to kind of bring people back down to earth, don't you, Emma?
Yeah, we help the physicians do that. The physicians have the lion's share of that communication, but we certainly help support the patient because usually by then the patient has developed a relationship with their nurse, and so they are the trusted source that they confide in.
What other sorts of questions do you get from people? They say, I heard about this on, you know, WebMD.
Well, really anything around their treatment, a lot of it is treatment specific, what medication they can get, what intervention they can get. But usually it's because they've read something on the internet that might not be specific to their situation.
Again, the number for you to join us is 1-800-892-6477. And all of you, let's go to our listeners. Jillian's calling from Hudson. Hi, Jillian. Go ahead. You're in The Exchange.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I work with the American Cancer Society Cancer Action Network. We're the advocacy affiliate of the American Cancer Society. And I had a couple of comments. First, I was curious what the panelists thought about whether the federal government would come through with some of the funding for the National Institutes of Health for this cancer moonshot. And also, I wanted to encourage listeners who might be out there who care about this issue to go to onedegreeproject.org, which is our program, you know, everybody's one degree away from cancer, and they can go there and sign a petition and ask their member of Congress to support making cancer a national priority and putting more funding towards finding cures and the great work that Dr. Byring is doing.
Well, and Jillian, thanks for the call. And I remember in the 2014 elections, people from your group, you know, coming out to events and posing questions to candidates and so forth. What have you seen, Dr. Byring? Lots of talk, but any real cash behind that talk in terms of the moonshot and federal funding for research?
Well, the first point I would make for everyone, for the listeners, is that this money is effective. The money that's going into cancer research is really making a difference, and I'm a researcher, unlike Dr. Bookbinder, who's a clinician as well as a researcher. I don't see patients, but I understand the research. And the money that's coming through the cancer research, both from the federal government and from the various foundations and agencies that are raising the money, it's very effective. It is making a difference. Now, what will happen with the funding at the federal level? I really don't want to hazard a guess because it's so complicated the way anything gets done in Washington.
Do you want to comment, Dr. Bookbinder?
No, I agree. I mean, I think I'm very hopeful that we will see funding, and I'm hopeful that a lot of these projects will move forward. I'm hopeful that even if some of the money doesn't materialize, some of the cooperation and some of the working together that's been inspired by this will continue through other funding mechanisms and through other projects. But obviously, we'll have to see.
So we're still waiting to see 6 months out.
Yeah.
Wow. Okay. Go ahead, Dr. Byring.
As far as we know, I don't think Congress has allocated money for it.
Yeah.
Let's go back to our listeners. And Jillian, thank you again for jumping into our conversation today. The number 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. It's part two of our series on cancer. We're looking at different types of treatment, especially focusing on one new one, immunotherapy, that's caused a lot of excitement. And Deidre's calling from Deerfield. Hi, Deidre. Go ahead.
Hi.
Go ahead. You're on the air, Deidre.
Hi. I had high-dose chemotherapy in a clinical trial 21 years ago for stage 3 breast cancer. And I would like to speak to the long-term effects of treatment. I don't think when I was being treated that any of my oncologists were actually thinking about long-term. They were thinking more about getting me a little extra time.
Wow. Well, they got you a lot of time, didn't they, Deidre? Here you are 21 years later.
Deirdre.
And Deirdre, yes, yeah.
And here I am 21 years later.
Right.
My surgeon still loves to see me, and I think it's just because I'm breathing. <You
know>? So high-dose chemotherapy sounds like that was pretty traumatic.
It was. It was very traumatic. I also had radiation, although I had a mastectomy, and I had a pretty aggressive mastectomy. And I had immediate reconstruction with a TRAM flap, which is a transverse rectus abdominal muscle that they take from your stomach and move along with other tissue that failed in like 2 weeks. So I started chemo with this big smile from hip to hip of a scar. And I've had two subsequent reconstructions, and they both failed as well because of irradiated tissue.
Well, Deirdre, you've been through the ringer, and good for you that you're here with us. Dr. Bookbinder, what do you think? 21 years ago, she says the docs didn't seem to really, you know, obviously you can't comment on her particular situation, but that doctors were less concerned about side effects. They just wanted to blast you with chemo and fix it.
Yeah, it's one of the things that I think we've been focusing a lot on and has been really changing over the many years is looking at, do we need to go with such high doses? Can we adjust things? As Emma mentioned, better and better medications to control symptoms, and how much do we actually need to do? Can we do less and still get as good effects in terms of chemotherapy? And in the realm of immunotherapy, we're hitting up against a lot of this because some of these treatments are so new. We don't know what is going to happen in 20 years to patients when we have given medications that alter their immune systems if there's going to be a long-term effect, because we haven't been giving them long enough to know these that yet. And so it is something where, you know, every new thing we do has a little element of unknown there in terms of what is it going to look like long-term.
So, Dr. Buchbinder, again, Emma described for us the symptoms that, you know, chemotherapy patients go through. What side effects are there from immunotherapy?
So the immunotherapy side effects are very different from chemotherapy, and part of that is why they occur. So what can happen is when we give these immunotherapies, we're turning on the immune system to recognize the cancer, but we can't always only turn it on to recognize the cancer. So sometimes we turn on the immune system in a way that it attacks normal tissue, so the colon or the lungs or the liver or the skin or other organs within the body. And when that happens, what happens is patients get symptoms related to that. So, for example, if the immune system attacks the lungs, it causes inflammation in the lungs that causes trouble breathing and cough and can lead to actually really bad problems with the lungs. And so what we have figured out is we can then dampen down that immune response with steroids, but in some cases those side effects can become very severe. And when we give very high doses of these immunotherapies, immune modulating agents, sometimes we can end up having patients end up in the hospital requiring high doses of steroids or other medications, requiring monitoring, and there have even been some deaths from the immune treatments. So although we're doing things that are kind of using your body to fight cancer, there still is some potential for very severe side effects, and it requires close monitoring while we give these therapies.
Wow, that's too bad. And Emma, I want to turn to you. You know, it's nice to hear about another therapy. Everybody knows the side effects of chemo and radiation, but it sounds like your patients have some side effects from this as well.
This is certainly something that the team looks for. And what's different is that these side effects don't happen when the patient's in the chair or immediately after. These can be very delayed side effects. And so it takes a careful eye and careful assessment by the medical team to really care for these patients and look for the side effects.
So when they leave your office, they think, oh, okay, I'm feeling pretty good. I like this new immunotherapy.
Potentially, and that's why the patient teaching is so important. And we spend a lot of time reinforcing that teaching, that if they feel something wrong or different, that they should be calling our office 24/7.
Wow. And what sorts of side effects have you seen? Dr. Buchbinder mentioned a few, but...
Yeah, I think the liver toxicity, the lung toxicity, the skin toxicity related specifically to immunotherapy, those are the ones that we have seen. And if they get severe enough and we can't manage them outpatient, the patients do have to go to the hospital to have them managed.
Again, our number for you to join us in the exchange is 1-800-892-6477. Deirdre, thank you for that call. 1-800-892-NHPR. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Dr. Buchbinder talked a little bit earlier about who this immunotherapy might work for. And, of course, a lot of people heard about Jimmy Carter and his melanoma. Who doesn't this work for?
Well, I think that the short answer for that is that the research has not gotten to the point where we really understand what the signals are, what the diagnostic and pathologic signals are as to who's going to respond. But I think that there's one point I'd kind of like to make for the listeners, because I think it helps put this into context. So I think it's a very good analogy to compare the way the immune system interacts with pathogens, with bacteria and viruses, with the way it interacts with tumors. And as we learn more and more about pathogens, we realize that there's a very complex interaction in which pathogens are actively protecting themselves from the immune system. And I think that's important to realize when you ask the question like, okay, if the immune system recognizes cancer, then why do we get it?
Right. Why doesn't it just take care of it for us?
And the answer is that the tumors that become a clinical issue, the ones that a doctor like Dr. Buchbinder might have to deal with in a patient, have developed ways of suppressing the immune response against themselves.
I see.
And so that, I think, is a really important point to realize. And then you get into the question of like, well, who will it work for? And it somewhat depends on how that individual tumor is protecting itself against the immune system, and then what the immunotherapy that's going to try to overcome that, what we call immunosuppression, how will we try to overcome the immunosuppression, and will it work for that individual tumor? So once again, gets back to the fact that a particular type of cancer, although the pathologist may look at it on the slide and say, well, they all look like X, Y, or Z, at the molecular level, they may be quite different, and they may need different immunotherapy approaches.
Wow. So, Dr. Fiering, we talked earlier in the show about, you know, cancer isn't just one disease, even though it's often talked about that way. It's hundreds of diseases. It almost sounds like, from what you're saying, that it's an individual disease, that every single person will present differently.
I think there is some truth to that. Certainly, the array of genetic changes in every cancer is unique, but I think there are tendencies. There are groups of genes and pathways that get activated or shut down that are tending to be common between a particular type of cancer within those patients all having that type.
Dr. Buchbinder, how expensive are these immunotherapy drugs?
So they are pretty expensive. The initial drug that we started using for melanoma, which goes by the name of ipilimumab, is only given as four doses. And the price paid for that ranges, I couldn't even say how high it potentially gets, but probably for a course of four therapies starts around $100,000. So it definitely
$100,000?
Definitely is a pretty expensive therapy. I think there are there's variability in terms of, you know, relationships between drug companies and insurances in terms of how much what gets paid and patients getting access to that. But there definitely is a very high price tag associated with that.
Do you want to talk about Emma, at all? Again, you're working with patients on the care side, but I wonder if they talk to you about, I'm so excited about this therapy, but I can't pay for it.
So this has become an evolving field for us, that we have to proactively mention to patients that their care is expensive, but that we have help for them. We have a social worker on site. We can help. We can work with the drug companies to have some financial assistance. We can look for foundation support. There is a lot of options for patients, but we want to proactively mention it so that they tell us when they have concerns.
Well, and in our next segment, we're going to be talking more specifically about that, the administrative nightmare of cancer treatment and the financial nightmare that it can be for some people. But just to close out with you, I think, Dr. Fiering, any final thoughts that you want to leave us with about the promise and whether we should get excited about immunotherapy or not too excited?
There's no doubt we should be excited about immunotherapy. I think that it's going to, there's a lot of research that has to be done, but it's moving rather quickly because of all the investment that's gone on over the years. The research moves very fast now. Immunotherapy will become a huge contribution to better outcomes for cancer. I think that I'm absolutely convinced of that, and I think it's very exciting, and I think it's going to really, once again, lift the outcomes. People are going to be able to live with these diagnoses for many more years, and I hope Jimmy Carter is a great example of it.
Well, both of you, Dr. Buchbinder and Dr. Fiering, thank you very much for being with us. We really appreciate your time.
It's a pleasure.
Thank you.
That's Dr. Elizabeth Buchbinder. She's at the Dana-Farber Cancer Institute in Boston. And Dr. Stephen Fiering, he's at Dartmouth College's Geisel School of Medicine. Coming up, we'll talk more about the financial costs of cancer care. So stay with us. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, it's part two of our series on cancer. This hour, we've been talking about cancer treatment and some of the advances. We turn now, though, to the idea of the financial toll of cancer treatment, the administrative nightmare that it can be for some patients. 1-800-892-6477 is the number for you to join us with your comments, questions, concerns, personal stories. 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhs.gov. HPR.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. With me in studio is Emma Dan, Nurse Director at the Dana-Farber Cancer Institute Satellite Office in Londonderry. And with us now from Duke University is Dr. Youssef Zafar. He's a medical oncologist who treats patients with gastrointestinal cancer at Duke Cancer Institute. And Dr. Zafar, welcome. Thank you very much for being with us, and welcome.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Well, and you have written and talked a lot about what's called logistic toxicity, financial toxicity, and it turns out this can affect patient health as well. What's the administrative toll of a cancer diagnosis, Dr. Zafar, as if the, you know, health toll wasn't bad enough?
It's a lot more than we can even measure, I'll tell you that. You know, you're absolutely right. So, you know, we see a patient who has just been diagnosed with a catastrophic illness, and what many of those patients don't realize is, in addition to having to experience the diagnosis and the treatment related to it, they also end up with a, in some cases, considerable financial burden that they have to deal with. What we've learned over time, that financial burden can impact patients' well-being, can impact their quality of life, and it can actually impact the quality of their care as well.
So the stress of just worrying about how to pay for this can actually affect the outcome, Dr. Zafar?
It can. So, you know, we've done a study that found that quality of life in patients who have financial burden is a lot worse than in cancer patients who don't experience financial burden. We know that patients who can't afford to pay for their cancer treatment won't take it. And those patients have a considerably higher chance of not being adherent to their treatment because of that cost. And of course, if patients aren't taking their cancer treatment, we know what that can do to their outcomes.
How much recognition do you think, Dr. Zafar, there has been of this, you know, link between the financial stress, the administrative stress, and the health outcomes?
Well, I think more and more the recognition is coming. I think as oncologists, we all understand that our patients are struggling to pay for some of these expensive treatments despite having insurance. I think where the challenge is finding the solution, you know, finding the intervention to help decrease patients' financial toxicity.
Well, and I've definitely heard you talk about, okay, we've discussed this a lot, let's start looking at solutions. Emma, I want to bring you in, though, to, you know, as we said, a cancer diagnosis is terrible enough. What's the administrative toll that you see for your patients?
So we are in a medical oncology clinic, and so our patients find us after they've already started to navigate the system. And so they are sometimes still very confused about the link between their primary care provider, their surgeon, their radiation oncologist. But when they come to us, we help them to continue to try to put those pieces together. But this is new. A lot of our patients were previously healthy, and so they aren't used to navigating the healthcare system. And especially in oncology, the healthcare system can be very complicated. And so to try to break that down and expose them to a lot of new terms, a lot of new professionals, can be somewhat overwhelming.
Well, and they're reeling still from the diagnosis. So sometimes you may be giving the message, but it may not be getting through, Emma.
Absolutely. The emotional impact here is huge.
So how do you work through that without completely overwhelming the person?
So we try to still give them the information up front. We encourage them to bring a loved one to the appointment with them so that maybe the loved one can be at a better place to hear it and the two of them. We also encourage them to bring a notebook or just some way of taking notes and referencing back later. But really, it's about the reinforcing at every visit, during every phone call, you know, just encouraging them to call us, that really sharing that information from the beginning till the end, because you can never have too much information.
Well, and you talked earlier about the cancer team, and in one sense, that sounds great. Wow, I've got a whole team of people behind me. On the other hand, it's almost easy if you can just deal with one person or two people. I mean, how many people make up that cancer team?
So clinic to clinic, that varies. But really, we look to all the different disciplines between the physician's assistants or nurse practitioners, the nursing team, the nursing assistants. You have social work, you have nutrition, you have rehab.
Wow.
And I know I'm missing a lot more, but psychiatry. And really, we, as the primary caregivers, try to sort out which patient would best help this patient.
Well, and Dr. Zafar talked about the financial burden. What are you seeing? He said that sometimes if people feel like they can't afford it, they won't take it. And nobody wants that, right? You want people to be cured.
That is absolutely true. It ended up not being an issue, but we had a patient just last week who said, if my insurance is not paying for this, I'm not going to be treated. And he had a cancer that would have significantly responded to the treatment. And he ended up getting it. It was fine. But, you know, that happens. That is real. He was choosing to pay his other bills rather than his cancer treatment, if it came to that.
So, Dr. Zafar, nobody wants to hear that story, right? The guy had a cancer that could have been treated, and he was concerned that he wouldn't be able to take that treatment. What do you, as the doctor, do about that?
You know, I guarantee you that you've got listeners right now who have been in similar situations. I think it's a lot more widespread than we even realize. But, you know, that question is really important, is what do we do about it? I think you know, patients are reluctant to bring up their, you know, financial strain with their healthcare providers because in some cases they feel they might get lesser quality care if it's less expensive care. And that's not true for the vast majority of time. And providers are reluctant to bring up costs because they don't want patients to think that cost is foremost in their mind. But I'll tell you, you know, there's two different discussions. There's cost to society. You know, you talk about the cost of a drug like ipilimumab that's incredibly expensive, and we need to figure out ways for our health system to pay for it. But then there's also the discussion around affordability of care, and that's where I think we need to do more work, is have, you know, patients and providers sit down and check in every once in a while to see if their treatment is affordable. And if it is not, then refer them earlier rather than later to assistance programs or to financial counselors or social workers who have resources at their fingertips to help.
Go ahead, Emma.
And additionally, it's not just the cost of the drugs, but the cost of traveling to care or having your child care or being out of work. I mean, it's beyond the actual cost of the drugs or the radiation or the surgery.
Wow. So that's an important point, Emma. So it's the cost of the drugs. It's the cost of paying for the team, the professionals like you who work with patients. But then there's the other stuff. You know, I've got to be in treatment all day. What do I do with my child? Or I can't work for 5 weeks because I'm recovering from chemo. What about that lost income?
Absolutely. That's a big thing that we have our social work team involved with to try to help. But, and, you know, things like if they have to go into Boston, we'll try to give them gas cards or parking vouchers. But those are real costs that are associated with the treatment.
Again, our number for you to join us is 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. Again, 1-800-892-6477. Dr. Zafar, I came across some pretty sobering statistics. I'm sure you're familiar with them. People with cancer are twice as likely to declare bankruptcy because of the disease. Is this across the board, Dr. Zafar? Patients with no insurance, people with good insurance, people with scanty insurance, or is it more for people who have no insurance?
Well, you know, I think definitely patients who are uninsured are at high risk. Though in many cases, those patients who are uninsured end up getting, you know, caught by a safety net or end up getting care for free in some instances, though that's becoming less and less common. The patients that I end up being most concerned about are underinsured patients. So these are patients who have insurance but don't realize that they have poor quality insurance until they get hit with that catastrophic illness. So they don't have prescription drug coverage, or they have co-insurance, which, you know, we're seeing more and more now, or high deductible plans that lead to high out-of-pocket costs despite having insurance. So in many cases, those are the patients I'm most concerned about.
When did you sort of make the shift, Dr. Zafar, from, I mean, obviously you're still working in the field of medical oncology, but when did you start really paying attention to this with your patients?
Well, I think it happened around the time of the economic downturn, where I noticed in clinic, patients were telling me more and more frequently that they either couldn't afford their treatment or, like Emma said, they couldn't afford to travel all the way to Duke for CT scans or for treatment, and they needed to decrease the frequency of their visits. And I realized that these were all patients who were insured. And as a researcher, I started looking into that and realized we didn't really understand how patients were coping with the financial burden of their cancer treatment. So it really came from the patients that I was seeing on a daily basis.
You know, and I'm guessing, Dr. Zafar, that it's surprising for some patients. You know, they think, I have health insurance and, you know, my insurance is pretty decent and cancer is a bad illness and insurance is supposed to take care of you when you're sick. So I'm guessing a lot of people come to you and say, I thought this was covered.
Absolutely. And I think the timing is awful because, again, there are patients who are dealing with this new diagnosis, new side effects related to their treatment, and at the same time realize that their insurance is not what they expected. And, you know, I think Emma mentioned earlier as well, these are patients who have not necessarily interacted with the health system before. So they've never really tested the boundaries of their insurance and what it covers.
Why doesn't insurance cover cancer treatment? It seems like insurance takes care of you. It's health insurance, and cancer is clearly a health problem.
Sure. It's not that insurance doesn't cover cancer treatment. It absolutely does. But what we're seeing is we're seeing two or three different things happen. So first, patients are being treated for longer than they ever have before, and they're tolerating treatment better. Second, the treatments that we're prescribing them are much more expensive. Logarithmically, so more expensive than, you know, a few decades ago. And third, we're seeing greater cost sharing. And what I mean by that is insurance companies are shifting some of the cost of the treatments that we prescribe over to patients in the form of copays and coinsurance and high deductibles. So it's not that the treatment's not covered. It's just that patients are paying a greater portion of those costs.
Well, both of you, let's go back to our listeners. And Ray joins us from Litchfield. Hi, Ray. Go ahead. You're in the exchange. Thanks for calling in.
Oh, hi. Thanks. I spoke with you last week on your first program.
Oh, great. Okay.
You know, but the we have insurance, and it has a high deductible of $5,500 per person or $6,850 maximum out of pocket. And, you know, when I was diagnosed earlier this year, the facility I go to, the doctors I go to, they have a health benefit coordinator, and they were able to line up a couple of rent for me to pay for that out-of-pocket expense. So now, you know, everything is covered 100%, and I don't know how much your guests know about the different grants.
Wow, and Ray, your phone's kind of crackling out on us, so I will let you go, but I'm sorry to hear about your diagnosis. I'm glad you were able to get some help. He mentioned grants, Emma, that cover, you know, almost 100% of his costs. That's wonderful.
That is something that our social work team works very hard on, is trying to find additional funding to bridge that gap between the patient responsibility and where insurance kicks in. And there are plenty available, but you have to look for them, and it's hard, and having a professional help you is much appreciated.
Who funds those grants? Where does that money come from?
Oh, I can't specifically answer that, but there are a lot of organizations that participate in funding.
Yeah. Dr. Zafar, you want to answer that as well?
Sure. I think it really varies per organization and foundation. There are pharmaceutical sponsored patient assistance programs for drugs specifically. There are foundations as well, nonprofit foundations that not only provide help with drug costs, but also provide help with travel and rent and paying other bills. And a lot of those foundations rely on philanthropy.
Go ahead, Emma.
Additionally, like we're at the Dana-Farber, and so donating to the Jimmy Fund, that also has a component of patient assistance. You know, so a lot of those organizations have donations that are received that are then funded right back to patients.
Let's take another call. And again, Ray, thank you for that one. And good luck with your diagnosis. Here's Mike in Bedford. Hi, Mike. You're on the exchange. Welcome.
Hi, Laura. This is Mike Rollo with the American Cancer Society. How are you?
Fine. Thanks for calling in, Mike.
I'm great, thanks. I just wanted to make sure that your listeners knew that there were resources actually available to them here in New Hampshire. That the Cancer Society provides, such as rides to treatment through our Road to Recovery program, patients outreach for breast cancer patients, a whole host of programs that are available, and that if anyone needs help in the state of New Hampshire, there's an 800 number they can call, and we will connect them with specific services if they need financial assistance, if they need assistance dealing with their insurance companies. There's a whole host of anything you can imagine. There's more than likely the resources through the American Cancer Society right here in New Hampshire to them.
How concerned are you that people are making treatment decisions that perhaps they shouldn't because of financial burdens?
I think we're very concerned. That's why we worked with the legislature this past last year, to get a oral chemotherapy parity bill passed where out-of-pocket costs would be capped at $200 per prescription. So that law goes into effect 1st of January of next year. So
you can't charge more for
it. Yeah, we've been very active in this, obviously, for over 100 years.
Right. Well, Mike, thank you very much for being with us. We appreciate it.
We'd like your listeners to know what the information is. If you haven't, you've had two episodes now on cancer in New Hampshire, but you haven't had anyone from the Cancer Society on. So the number would be 800-227-2345.
Give that again, Mike. Go ahead.
It's 800-227-2345.
All right. Great to have you, Mike. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you.
And Dr. Zafar, just to close out with you, please, anything else that you really want listeners to think about as they, you know, look at the administrative hassles that Emma described and the financial toll that you have described?
So I think a lot of it has to do with communication. I think patients who are particularly new to healthcare and are facing a new diagnosis are concerned about bringing up topics like this for a lot of different reasons related to cost or the administrative burden. But communicating with your provider is critical, and we are here to help you in any way that we can. We, as your providers, need to know what you as a patient are experiencing, whether that's physical toxicity or financial toxicity. So I think communication is important, and education is important as well, and understanding the aspects of insurance coverage that might impact the quality of your care.
Well, Dr. Zafar, thank you very much. We know you're a busy guy. Thanks for taking time out for us.
You're welcome. Thanks for having me.
That's Dr. Youssef Zafar, medical oncologist who treats patients with gastrointestinal cancer at Duke Cancer Institute. And Emma Dan, it was really nice to meet you, too. Thank you for coming in.
It was great to be here. Thank you.
Emma Dan, nurse director at the Dana-Farber Cancer Institute Satellite Office in Londonderry. And remember, our conversation always continues online, on Facebook, and at nhpr.org. We'll also put a link to the American Cancer Society on our website. This is The Exchange on NHPR.